You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie. A while ago, Professor Rob Watts gave a speech about New Start and the undeserving poor. And the reason for why it was particularly interesting to be playing some of it today is you'll realise that in the last budget that it's been worked out that for New Start to bring people above the Henderson poverty line, it would have to be increased by $25 a week, $25 a day, sorry, $25 a day, for it to raise people to the level of the Henderson poverty line. What did happen at the budget was that it was raised $20 a week. So $25 a day versus $20 a week. Now, that's better than a kick in the teeth, but it's not adequate, quite clearly. There were other things that happened in the budget. They did extend the time a single parent gets to get the higher payment, higher than New Start, from the time the child reaches 4 years to 8 years. Now, that's better than a kick in the teeth as well. And they also did a couple of things that related to what they call the social contract, I suppose. They extended bulk billing provisions in some respects. And there's a few of those kind of things that they did. But given that there's this stark connection between keeping people on incredibly low New Start and poverty in Australia, I think it was worthwhile going back a little and having a historical perspective on how Australia got to the social security arrangements that we have. So let's have a little hear from Professor Rob Watts for a little bit of an overview.
So the first point that I'd make is a simple one. We're living in very dark times. For the better part of the last four decades, we have seen a neoliberal makeover, engineered by successive governments since the Hawke-Keating governments began in March 1983. David Harvey succinctly sums up what a neoliberal makeover looks like. It's a political project that pretends to be something other than a political project. It's based on a theory of economic practice, that says human well-being can be best advanced if we hand everything over to a market-type process, in which we also then protect individual property rights or corporate property rights, free markets and ideas like free trade. None of this is actually what's going to happen, but that's the story that you're going to tell. The role of the state is then redefined to be an idea about creating and preserving a framework for these kinds of practices. Now, as Marcus Banks and his colleague Diana Bowman have pointed out, what we've seen actually happen in Australia is the use of state frameworks of policy, regulation, intervention, all the rest of it, to create a neoliberal social insecurity state. It's not a security state, it's an insecurity state where you render insecurity an endemic feature of large numbers of ordinary Australians' lives. And this is represented in various ways as educational policy, social policy, industry policy, blah, blah. What you get, and we've now seen, and it begins precisely under the Hawke-Keating government, is a combination of precarious employment, that is the return to precariousness, because that used to be the old norm until the 1940s. It's also about the creation of a system in which low and inconsistent wages becomes increasingly normative, in which you see an increasingly conditional and punitive system of welfare payments, if you can call them welfare payments, accompanying relentless increases to the cost of living that end up making life emotionally, economically, financially insecure and stressful for many Australians, not just those at the bottom end of the income pile. It's no thing to be proud of that we now have the third largest proportion of part-time workers in the OECD, the big 32 capitalist countries, just behind Netherlands and Switzerland. About 40% of employment now in this country is non-standard. That is, it's no longer whatever it used to be when we had an effective if flawed, industrial relations system. And the current system, if you want to call it that, of social insecurity for people of working age, that's 15 to 64 is my focus here. The current system of social insecurity is not working. When Australia, as a white colonial space, was created, we brought into this space some long-standing ideas about the benefits of work and the criminal and deviant status of people who didn't work. They were called paupers. And the English, or British, mostly it's English history, was a long-term history which arcs back to the Elizabethan period in the late 15th, 16th century, when a system of poor law relief began to be constructed both locally and at the central level in London. That system creates a fundamental idea. There are people who are worthy and there are people who are not. Those who are not are to be punished. Those who are worthy will get something, provided they keep on being worthy, which is to say, socially obedient. From the origins, then, of whatever we're going to mean by our system of welfare, and most of it was run for much of the 19th century and well into the 20th century, we're talking about a network of charitable, philanthropic and church-based activities. Again, it's a matter of some record that the chief source of unemployment relief, for example, in a state or colony like Victoria, was a network of ladies' benevolent societies. There was one of those in every suburb, and they were what they sound like. They were committees run by ladies who would hand out effectively various kinds of food and clothing relief. They did not like to hand out money, and it is this system which headed straight into the crisis that began in the 1920s, not in 29, but probably in the mid-20s in places like Melbourne and Sydney, when rising unemployment began to manifest itself for the first time in a serious way in four or five decades. That system of ladies' benevolent societies was the primary response to mass unemployment. And those of you who know the history will know that in suburbs like South Melbourne, Collingwood, Richmond, Fitzroy, the unemployment rate was running at 90%. 90%. And the rates at which people were being evicted was running in the order of 500 to 600 in each week of houses in which police would move people on and out. My own parents remember being moved in Footscray, moving out, I think, once every 2 months. They'd scrape together a bit of rental, move into the house and do the midnight flit the day before the guillotine dropped and would then move to another place. That was what people did back then, in the day, as we might say. The moral economy, in short, of the distinction between the deserving and the undeserving was not accompanied by the institutional mechanisms which were created in Britain over the 200 to 300 years of what we'll call the Industrial Revolution. We did not create a poor law system. There was legislative enactments that required local governments from the onset here in Victoria, for example, from the 1850s, to set up poor law mechanisms, but they never did it. They just refused. They wouldn't have a bar of it. So it was left to charity, church groups and so on to provide whatever was to become the unemployment relief that was to be available. The exception to that story is Queensland did in 1919 introduce a system of unemployment insurance. That made it a very odd state. It's remained an odd state. And, of course, it worked somewhat in the 1920s, particularly in outback Queensland, to provide unemployed workers with some minimal system of relief. But because of the design problems with unemployment insurance, it was never going to be all that effective anyway. The second point to be made is that, and you can't emphasise this enough, Australia is an odd society when it comes to the provision of welfare. We are the one society on earth which decided not to set up an unemployment insurance system. We are exceptional. We are so exceptional as to, and the word unique here does actually mean what it means. We're the only society that's done it this way. That is to say, unemployment insurance is a what it sounds like. It's a scheme in which workers contribute from their income, their wage income, to a fund such that when they become unemployed, they can draw on that fund as of right. That was the scheme, the logic that was set up, first of all, under Bismarck in Germany in the 1880s. and it would be the model that would be adopted everywhere else around the world. Australia chose not to do that. What we set up, and it was set up initially in the context of the Second World War, was a scheme based on taxation. There was no expectation that employers would contribute to this, nor that the government would contribute to this. It was to be funded by general taxation that was imposed for the very first time in 1942 on all Australians. Now, again, you need to remember that taxation was not something that most Australians paid until 1942. And it was in the context of a dramatic crisis that was occasioned by the eruption of war with Japan and the bombing of Darwin concentrated mines wonderfully in Australia at that point. So the origins of what we would see as emerge as a scheme of national social security have their origins in a total war setting, a great deal of concern about how we would get through the war, the decision to create a taxation system, and the, to put it in as simple terms as one can, a scheme was created of unemployment benefits, sickness benefits, what we'd call sort of widow's benefits and all the other sorts of benefits that become part of what we now would learn to call the Australian welfare state in the period 41, 42, 43, 44, was basically designed to make the imposition of taxes palatable. It was not done because of any flush of generosity or a sense of social justice. It was a crude economic project in which the key economists, most of them Keynesians, who were becoming part of the new dispensation in economic policy, decided that they needed to make the imposition of taxes palatable to people who had never been asked to pay them in the past. That is, working class people, with the impost of taxes reaching right down to the bottom income groups in this country. The scarifying effects of the Great Depression were such that there was a general determination never to allow the impact of mass unemployment to occur again. So by 1944, again with the advice of key economists and international agreements that were emerging on the part of the Allies, the Australian government embraced a formal commitment to full employment. It issued a white paper on full employment. America would pass legislation to that effect, 1946. The British government, Canadian, the New Zealanders would all formally embrace a commitment to full employment in which the relevant nation state undertook to provide all of the economic policies that would secure full, and let's just put the word in brackets, male employment. And that would be the core accomplishment of the war period. And so when Reconstruction begins in 1945, we have Australian government formally committed. And it's a bipartisan commitment, so that even the Menzies Liberal Party, as it's newly created at that point, is committed to a project of policy, economic regulation, a whole raft of policies which would include interest rates set by the National Bank, the Reserve Bank, Commonwealth Bank. Immigration would be part of the story, investment in industry, a network of employment services would be created, the Commonwealth Employment Service, and all the rest that was created with a view to securing the conditions of full employment as a real project for the post-war period. As we know, that project would last precisely almost three decades. It comes under attack in a number of different directions from both things happening in the economy but also from political, ideological changes around about 1975. And at that point, as we say, the story changes. The effect of full employment for much of the period from 45 to 75 was such as to render the problem of unemployment essentially non-existent, if you don't take into account women's experience and or Indigenous people in the far outback. But in broad terms, for the normal urban Australian, full employment, backed by the elaborate apparatus of industrial regulation, which included something called the basic wage, which is another idea. Remember that the basic wage was the idea that families had a right to a living wage. It was not one based on any determination of industry's capacity to pay. That little idea would be inserted into the conversation nationally whilst Bob Hawke was representing the ACTU in 1969. That would be the first nail in the coffin, if you like, of a certain conception of what a fair society should look like based on a mandated idea about living wages. So the 70s really become a kind of crucial turning point, and there's a whole series of elaborate discussions we had about how that happens, who's responsible, what role did the Whitlam Labor government have in this. There's a fair bit of myth-making about Whitlam as a sort of the last of the great social democrats. That's essentially a bullshit story. He was responsible for the first great experiment in mass unemployment when he decided to impose tariff cuts at the advice of Alf Rattigan, the head of the Department of Trade, who was a avant la lettre, before the ideology becomes a formal policy commitment, a neoliberal. So we do see the changes beginning in the mid-70s under Whitlam, and then there's a period of chaos under Fraser, and then I think we can say with some certainty now that the neoliberal experiment begins in full force, courtesy of a Labor government. It was a convention back then in the 80s to assume that only nasty right-wing governments would embrace neoliberal policy. So you'd expect it of Thatcher, you'd expect it of Reagan, but not of a Labor government, surely. Well, I think that just tells us something about people's capacity to believe anything. And certainly you had a skilled salesman in the form of Hawke. You had a compliant Labor movement. And you had even people who belonged to the left, Trotskyists, people from the Communist Party, who decided that Hawke was offering them a brand new order in which they would have a secure place at the seats of power.
You're on Solidarity Breakfast, and we're listening to part of a speech that was given by Professor Rob Watts. It was called New Start and the Undeserving Poor. And it's in relation to what happened at the budget last week, which was that instead of deciding to increase New Start to the Henderson poverty line, which would have required it to be raised $25 a day, the government was put decided that it would raise it $20 a week. And so I thought it would be worthwhile going back over the history of, Rob Watts is giving us a little history lesson on Australia's social security system. And there's just a little bit at the end, which it was a more expanded discussion about what could happen to make a better situation. But he's got an interesting reflection on what would happen if you actually increased New Start.
By 1986, it's apparent that the commitment to full employment has been killed off. No government in Australia will ever again commit to an idea like full employment. That idea is off the agenda. By 87, the OECD has come up with an idea. It's called the active society model. It basically says there's a problem. We are now in an era of permanent long-term unemployment. We can't afford to acknowledge this too openly. So we're not going to be able to return to full employment ever, because the market won't allow that anyway. So you just have to put up with naturally occurring levels of unemployment and inflation. You will need to nonetheless do something, and that is to not let the unemployed lose their morale. You'll need to keep their morale up by keeping them active. And this would lead to the first major review and overhaul of the Australian social security system since it was formed back in the mid-40s. Here we see the magical transformation of the problem of unemployment into the problem of the unemployed. The unemployed become the problem. It's their deficits that will become the focus of program after program. It's their lack of experience, it's their lack of stickativity, of resilience, financial capacity, blah, 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 blah. And the result will be what has now become an alarmingly complex system of increasingly discrete systems of benefits, payments, all paid at different levels with all sorts of strange and complicated and arcane rules of access and all the rest of it. That is the accomplishment of the 80s. The Cass Review means that we start to see things like the introduction of New Start and other forms of youth allowance. We see all the arcane elements, which are at this point still to be run through what was then the Department of Social Security and the old CES. And, of course, the next stage, which is part of the story that we can attribute to Paul Keating's government, is the beginning of the idea that we need to privatise and outsource the state-run elements of employment services. And this, of course, is occurring at the same moment as the great assault begins on the industrial relations system in its entirety. And at that point, I'd say much of the destructive work of the neoliberal makeover is effectively accomplished during the time that Hawke and then Keating are prime ministers. What's left for the coalition government when Howard comes into office in 97 is really some tidying up. There's some pushes and pulls to try and get more work being done. Meanwhile, at the state level, of course, you've got massive privatisation, because much of the stuff that's going to get flogged off, re-engineered, is in the hands of the state government, so you start selling off state banks and utilities and energy companies and all the rest of it. So the effect of all this, I think, is to create a new kind of order in which the focus, the rhetoric, the vocabulary is couched in terms of the unemployed, their problems, their deficiencies, and what we need to do to do things to them to make it somehow stick together. The essence of this is to say that, in a sense, though the nature of the economy, the society, the fabric of our community is utterly different by the 1990s to what it was like in colonial Australia back in the 1870s, for example, or even Australia in the 1920s, there is a continuous logic, a thread, and it's this thread that somehow says, within the terms of what we'll call a moral economy, some people are not deserving. Some people don't have fundamental rights. Some people don't deserve the kind of support that you might think a civilised society would wish everyone to have, and you're going to create an increasingly punitive, discriminatory and stigmatising system. And I think that's the effective... So what we see, I think, is through the late 20th and now the 21st century, is with all the new technological capacities that a modern surveillance state has, it can do much more in surveillance. It can make life much trickier, much harder for people who are caught up in the system. And the most recent versions of that, of course, we now start to see the obscenities of the sorts of things that go on, because you've got an algorithm that can generate letters of demand, such that leads then to a kind of a process of... endless harassment, suspension of payments, demands for repayment of monies that are imaginatively understood to be owed to the government, and so it goes on. I'm assuming that I don't need to persuade you that the system we've got now is unnecessarily complicated, unnecessarily stigmatising. It's no longer legitimate, and I think that's the fundamental point I'd want to start with. It's not legitimate in a moral or social sense. It does not require us to believe in it. There's nothing in it that's admirable, politically or morally. It's offensive, and it's a punitive system. And why we do this to people, I don't know. Now, if you'd asked me to do this a year ago, I probably would have banged on about the idea of a universal basic income. But I'm not going to do that tonight. Let me say, I think now that it's not an either-or. I think we can have a number of elements that come together. But let me make the case tonight for the following. The first thing we should do straight away is increase Newstart and double it. That will cost about $11.1 billion to double. So at the moment it's about 11.1, is that right? Something like that? Let's double that. That would bring it up to a basic minimum wage, standard of about $33,000 a year. That's not a lot of money. It's still grossly inadequate in all sorts of ways. But that would be the first thing I'd do. And if I was a government with some guts and a little bit of vision and maybe a strong leader in charge with some moral compass, I'd be doing that. Now, the first thing that people in Australia usually say is, where's the money coming from? Right, the answer is very simple. How many of you have heard of taxation expenditures? It's a form of revenue which you've decided not to seek. So you're handing back... And in a sense, if you want to put it in dramatic terms, it's what taxpayers agree to do to help you with your five investment properties, which you've borrowed money for, deliberately with a view to losing money, so that you can claim a discount on your entire taxable income. Negative gearing is an example of the 289 schemes which make it possible for wealthy individuals and or companies to evade tax. Welfare expenditure is the biggest single item of Commonwealth Government expenditure. Taxation expenditure is the second. I should add immediately, because the Tax Office, the ATO, is very clear about this when it says we actually can't estimate the totality of taxation expenditure. It's roughly in the order, they say, we can calculate it for about two-thirds of the schemes that are available. Yes, it's tax not collected by agreement. Now, negative gearing, I should add, is precisely worth $11.2 billion. So you could, in a stroke, and if the current opposition decides to proceed, it could decide, which I'm not going to believe it will, to knock off negative gearing, you could actually fund the increase in New Start allowance just from that one cut. Negative gearing is a very small part of the total picture of tax expenditure.
There you go. And you're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie, and we've just been listening to a speech that it was given a bit of a while ago by Professor Rob Watts, and it was entitled New Start and the Undeserving Poor. And of course, this present Labor government was in opposition then, but it just tells you how easy it would be to actually bring people up from the to the Henderson poverty line with a stroke of the pen. There you go.